Views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
Welcome to the hit show Beyond Grief Radio with Angie Corbett-Kuyper on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Are you struggling with loss? Are you willing to challenge everything you've been taught about life and death? Beyond Grief Radio is a space that explores beyond current self-limiting beliefs surrounding loss, offering radical healing which will come from the least likely of places. Join Angie on her journey, which includes science, medicine, and spirituality, proving that the body is merely a shell of our soul. It is possible to create an amazing life from the depths of pain. It is your life. It is your choice. Now, here's your host.
Hi, my beautiful listeners. Welcome to my program, Beyond Grief. And I am just so excited to have two amazing, amazing thought leaders with us today. And I hope that in this short period of time that we will bring just a sense of peace, a sense of calm about something that has been taboo in society for what I believe has been way too long and needless suffering. Please welcome my beautiful guests, both Dr. Raymond Moody and Lisa Smart. And I am going to start our program with Dr. Raymond Moody for this first segment, and then we'll go into the second segment with Lisa Smart. And then our next segment, you guys, will go into more of a conscious scientific look at a collective God, if you will, tying it all together, the connectedness of the universe. And then what projects that Dr. Moody and Lisa are working on together to bring some much needed enlightenment to this taboo of death. So here we go. Dr. Raymond Moody is the best-selling author of 11 books, which have sold over 20 million copies. His seminal work, which was published in 1975, is Life After Life. He completely changed the way in which we view death and dying. He has his latest book, which is called Glimpses of Eternity. And he is the leading authority on the near-death experience, a phrase that he coined in the late 70s. New York Times calls Dr. Moody the father of the near-death experience. And he is the recipient of many awards, including the World Humanitarian Award. And Dr. Moody, thank you for joining me.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on your program. And I'm just delighted to hear you again. We've met before in a conversation, but it's really nice to be on the program.
Oh, thank you. Yes. In fact, I met Dr. Moody. And do you mind if I call you Raymond?
Oh, please do. Yeah.
Yay. You guys, you do not understand the magnitude of this man and the impact that he has had on my life as well as millions. And I met Raymond, we met at the Shivananda Ashram in the Bahamas, which is a working Hindu ashram. He's going to be there November 26th to the 28th, and he does an amazing job, you guys, of going over the possibility of life after life. So, Dr. Moody, I kind of want to just start with, now my listeners are new to this, and a lot of my listeners are very new to the concept of anything other than there is nothing that happens except rest in peace and bye-bye, and I hope to see you in heaven if there is one.
Yes, 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 and I can understand that perspective very well. The circumstances of my early childhood were such that I was fortunately, as it turns out, insulated from all the religious stuff and only knew it through a lens of something that was not my family, if you know. I remember the first time I ever heard the word Christian was my grandmother, I did something like, I think I took off my bathing suit because it was wet night to walk into the house, and I walked into the house and my grandmother yelled at me because the people, that's the one of the few times, but because the people sitting next door on the porch would have seen me, and so she said, "They are Christians," which I thought was something that we were not, and that's about all I understood of it. My grandmom used to joke about religion, and so when I went to the University of Virginia at age 18, I went to study astronomy. And honestly, I can tell you that my notion of the afterlife was something that was formed in the pages of the cartoons, because my dad got the New Yorker magazine, and once upon a time there would be a cartoon of an angel standing there and I guess the pearly gates or whatever and clouds all around, and I thought it was like a cartoon. So the wake-up call was reading Plato's Republic. I was 18 years old and reading just the first few pages of Plato's Republic. I was hooked and I became a philosophy major then and there.
And you even said that Plato was your hero.
Yeah, well, he was, although I wouldn't want to meet him. I mean, he was sort of known among his group as, his name was Aristocles, actually, and Plato was his ring name. He was like a professional wrestler who won the Isthmian Games, the gold medal twice in wrestling, and you know, it was okay to break your opponent's fingers in that kind of wrestling. And so, but anyway, at the end of his Republic, there's this amazing story about a warrior named who was believed dead on the battlefield. And Plato obviously took this seriously, saying, you know, like, this guy got out of his body and he went through a passageway and he saw his life in review and all these things happened to him in the next life. And I was just intrigued by that because it was startling. And so I asked Professor Hammond about it. And he said, yeah, that these early Greek philosophers, there were several of them, who studied cases of people who had apparently died but revived. But at that point, I thought that was interesting, and that Plato took it as possible was, to me, startling. And so, but I never thought of it beyond the context of Greek philosophy until 3 years later I met Dr. George Ritchie, who was a professor of psychiatry there, who talked to student groups about his own near-death experience he had. And obviously George Ritchie was a very real person. I mean, he was just, first time I heard it from him, I knew that he thought it was real. What it was, I didn't know. To make a long story short, I went on and I got my PhD in philosophy, and I became a philosophy professor for 3 years. And during that time, heard these stories also from my students and from my colleagues who were professors there, and then went on into medical school in 1972 and continued to hear them from my own professors, from patients, from so just thousands and thousands of people over the years have told these experiences to me. And I never, you know, they say, oh, brain damage, right? It's the oxygen deprivation during the resuscitation attempt and so on. Well, that has never been plausible for me for two reasons. But one that I guess is the most impressive is to most folks would be that in 1972 or 73, one of my own medical school professors told me that when she was trying unsuccessfully to resuscitate her own mother, that she herself, my professor, had gotten out of her own body and saw this light and saw her mother there in spirit form, and then saw her body, own body down below, along with her mother's dead body. And so subsequent to that, I've heard hundreds and hundreds of these experiences that take place not to the person who almost dies and revived, but rather to the person standing there at the bedside who has an empathic co-living of any aspect of the near-death experience. It's really, some of this is rather anxiety-provoking. One is people, doctors I hear often say, what is that light? They say, you know, doctors have told me that at the point where they see a patient die, they sometimes see something exit the body from the upper part of the body, which may be described as a light or a golden grayish light, or relatives and friends at the assembled at the bedside may hear this too, or may see this too. Or people at the bedside may tell us that as their loved one dies, that they themselves seem to, from their point of view, leave their own bodies and rise up toward a light in the company of their dying loved one's spirit, and then they at some point come back and rejoin their bodies and their loved ones go on. And people say that in the bedside they see light fill the room during the death, or apparitions of apparently the dying person's deceased relatives coming there to escort them away. And most remarkably, and anybody who's standing up better sit down for this one, but it's a fairly common, I gather, for somebody at the bedside to empathically co-live the dying life review of somebody who passes away, which is shocking to me. I mean, holy mackerel.
And Dr. Moody, we have about 30 seconds, and so I want to stop us there, but I would like to continue because that is an oh my gosh reaction. And so we've got about 15 seconds. When we come back with Dr. Raymond Moody and Lisa Smart, we will continue this. And you guys, thank you for joining us today. Thank you, Lisa. Oh, thank you, Raymond. And we'll be right back.
Have you been searching for a push to step out and share your gifts with the world? Allow Charlene Hess to empower you to start shedding the layers of your ego that are holding you back and begin feeling connected to your heart so that you can shine your unique divine light and share your gifts with the world. Tune in to The Charlene Hess Show, Living on Your Heart's Edge, every first and third Friday at noon Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com. For more information, visit CharleneHess.com.
Welcome back, my beautiful listeners. We are with the beautiful Lisa Smart and Dr. Raymond Moody. And we did notice there was a little bit of noise, and my producer Carter today had said, you know, it just sounded like there was some voices, some talking. And Dr. Moody, what did you say?
I said, oh, I heard that too, but I thought it was just the voices in my head.
I just love that. Okay, so going back a little bit, before we left for break, Raymond was talking about how people sometimes at the bedside of their loved ones who are ready to pass kind of see the light, the apparitions, and empathic kind of death themselves or a life review. Can you finish that thought up, Raymond?
Yes, and most remarkable of those things to me is the fact that I have cases where the bystander at the death of somebody else has empathically co-lived that dying patient's life review. During near-death experiences, we hear patients say that during the experience, they saw their whole life pass in review. And this, in the case of shared death experiences of the bystanders, sometimes the bystanders sort of tune in on that, and which is a shocking thought to me. You know, I'm just trying to purchase some sort of past life review protector shirt. They don't have to watch it when it happens.
Well, no, let me ask you, that's a really good question. Let me ask you this question, because I am to the belief, because N no longer is just one, N is like thousands and thousands. And I think that's where people get stuck and they wonder why they're needlessly grieving, because we've been taught that, you know, and I have a quote, it is, you know, religion teaches us there's only one teacher. Life has taught me that there are many. And I've learned.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so my question to you, the life review, do you believe it's at a point of awareness, Raymond, that once you realize there's this whole other side that is unseen but is felt? What is your thought on that?
Thank you so much for that question, because, you know, people look to these near-death experiences for comfort in the loss of a loved one and so on. And they do provide that, I think. And because increasingly the knowledge, I think, or awareness that people are able to have that this apparently, to my still astonishment, is a reality, and that we can take comfort from them. And at the same time, even people with these profound near-death experiences tell us that when they lose their loved ones now, having had that experience, that in a funny sort of way, it makes the grieving more acute.
Right.
Because, you know, if somebody just thinks that there's an afterlife as a kind of rationalization because of their religion or something, then they can use that rationalization to not have to face the feelings like, oh, I'm not going to cry about grandma because we know from our religion that grandma's in a wonderful place. But people with near-death experiences, it's a different take, because to them it's not a rationalization. It's a matter of somewhere they were.
Right.
Something they directly experienced. So they tell me that what that experience does to them is makes the locus of the pain more specific. It's, you know, to say that, oh, I feel sorry for grandma, you know, is who after she's died, is maybe what we're trying to fight against. But the real deal is we miss our loved ones, right?
Yeah.
And people with near-death experience say this, that you realize, sure, they're fine, but that I still miss them is the point. But yeah, I think the increasing, I am very confident, not that I have made a logical conclusion, but from things I've heard, I'm feeling just very, very confident that what we call death is slipping over to another reality.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been thinking about this is something I think really needs to get out for as you're talking about in terms of grief, but also just in terms of the fascination of this question. And so my friend Lisa Smart and I have, who is a linguist, have set up sort of learning portal on online where we are giving webinars from medical doctors who have had their own near-death experiences or who have studied near-death experiences. For example, we're having a webinar soon with Dr. Evan Alexander, a Harvard neurosurgeon who in 2008 had a just really an unsurvivable infection, but nonetheless lived and had an astonishing experience to tell when he returned. Or Dr. Anthony Chicoria, who's a professor of orthopedic surgery in upstate New York, who was struck in the neck by lightning some years ago and had a cardiac arrest and a phenomenal near-death experience that led him to become, in addition to an orthopedic surgeon, an accomplished concert pianist. So we have some really, really phenomenal programs coming up. So this is,
and thank you so much for that great segue, because I would like to now bring in Lisa Smart, who you both are kind of co-conspirators in this wonderful journey. And with that, you guys, Lisa Smart is the author of Words at the Threshold. And as Dr. Moody had said, she's a linguist, educator, and she's a poet. And she founded the Final Words Project. And it was after she sat at the bedside with her father, she listened as her dad was skeptical and he was a rationalist, talking angels and talking about a green dimension. You guys, when we hear things like that, we go, oh, they're whack because they're losing it. But instead, her curiosity led her to start now in this huge healing and kind of taking those, not even kind of, but taking those words, taking those language patterns and being able to share it with us all. So, Lisa, welcome.
Oh, great to be here with you, Angie.
Yes.
Yeah. The Final Words Project changed my life because while I was open-minded about the possibility of something beyond this world, I mean, I was curious about it, as you said, and open-minded. I didn't have any real, I trained as a linguist. I was accustomed to seeing patterns in things and we're looking for patterns. And it was by seeing the patterns in language that I really began to see that something, you know, when we talk about an afterlife, it's so ethereal, right?
Right.
You know, we can't, and it's so easy to say, oh, it's just my imagination. And then Raymond talked, you know, when you start hearing about doctors having shared experiences with their patients, then some of these things that we have traditionally said are just your imagination, or many people have said that. When you start seeing patterns in the world that are tangible and concrete. So, for example, the language is something, you know, when I started writing words down and seeing patterns in the words that not only occurred at my father's bedside, but in the rooms of people who are dying, all around the country, now even the world, we're hearing what people's final words are. And you had made reference to my father and the angels. My father was one of the most skeptical people. He didn't believe in anything beyond this world. Mm-hmm. And he always made fun of me because I was more open-minded about it. And 3 days before he died, well, he was telling me for almost 2 weeks that he was seeing angels in the room with him, which stunned me. And then 3 days before he died, he said, okay, enough, enough. The angels say enough. 3 days left. And then indeed, 3 days later, he passed on. And wow. So it was that experience of him seeing the angels that made me it just made me curious, as you said, and also for the first time in my life, I thought, you know, if my father is seeing and witnessing something like this, perhaps there is some reality or there is truly some other dimension. Because, if it was just the medications, why would my father, who is not a believer, why would that be the thing he would hallucinate? Do you
right.
know what I mean? I mean,
yeah.
You could hallucinate 1,000 things.
Yeah.
And so why would a skeptic suddenly start seeing angels? Anyway, so that was one of the many really captivating things that I witnessed. And as I spoke to more people, and there are other researchers, we're doing this research in terms of visitors at the bedsides of people who are dying. You know, we're hearing it, I mean, 70 to 80% now, I'm hearing from other researchers, of people are experiencing having some kind of bedside visitation. And this research is, you know, started some of it years ago. So it's not, that part of it's not new. But the part that is new is tracking the language patterns. And I just feel honored to be the person who launched this study through the Final Words Project.
Yes.
With Raymond's wonderful, wonderful guidance.
And you guys started the Final Words Project in 2014. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
That was
Lisa's. You know, she started that project. It was something I had been noticing that as a medical doctor for some time, that because I had one of my areas in philosophy of language, and I had been interested in as a kid in Dr. Seuss and Lewis Carroll, and sort of carried that forward in studying philosophy. And to make a long story short, I had when I had noticed that terminal ill patients in the last few days or hours of life, they often go into this very, very obscure and often nonsensical language, which even though the people left behind realize it's nonsense, they say nonetheless that it affects them deeply in some way. So, and I had noticed that kind of nonsense that not just people who are dying speak, but also people with all kinds of other medical disorders, including just severe stress or various kinds of intoxications and delirium or psychosis, schizophrenics, for example, will talk nonsense. And when they do, strangely or incredibly, that the patterns and types of nonsense they speak are the same types of nonsense that people like Lewis Carroll and Dr. Seuss make up for as literature. And so that's just an insight I've carried forward through the years. And
I love that. And Dr. Moody, we are going to come back. You guys, we have to head off. I'm sorry for cutting you off. Let's come back and let's talk about more some of these patterns and Lisa, I think you called it the logic of nonsense. And Raymond, you've mentioned that as well. So why don't we come back and visit the types of language that you guys are hearing out there? So thanks, you guys, for listening. When we come back with the beautiful Lisa Smart and Dr. Raymond Moody.
Have you ever wondered if there's a way to heal the deep, hidden inner issues, wounds, beliefs, and traumas? The Journey into Spiritual Healing engages people in all areas of their lives to heal themselves and others. Tune in each month on Transformation Talk Radio as Dr. Jaffe brings conversations of healing of body, mind, and spirit as he merges the excellence of traditional medicine with the beauty of spiritual healing. For more information about Dr. Jaffe, this show, and his work, visit drjaffemd.com.
Welcome back, my beautiful listeners, with Lisa Smart and Dr. Raymond Moody, as we are discussing life after life and some of the language that goes along with some of these experiences. And when we cut off, and we're going to go back to you, Raymond, in a moment, but some of the patterns and the types of nonsense that we hear, and I left it out the last, but Lisa, could you describe, your dad had talked about, and you had mentioned it was so beautiful in poetry and metaphoric language. What did he say about your mom?
Well, the very first night that he became very ill, it was pretty unexpected. My dad walked out the front door of the house on a January evening. It was cold, in his underwear. Walked down a busy street in California, and when the police stopped him, he said, they said, sir, you know, they were helping him, and he said, I'm heading to the big art exhibition, and I'm carrying these boxes because the big art show is coming, and it's my wife's art show, and I got to get there. Well, there were no boxes in his hands, and there was no art show, but he was announcing that something big was coming. And the police took him to the hospital, and then he within 3 weeks, he passed on for a number of complicated reasons. But he used a metaphor, right? There was no big art show, but it was a metaphor that something big was mm-hmm. coming. And it was as if he were announcing his death. Now, at the time, all I thought was, I wrote everything down that I heard he said from the police report, because I wasn't there, but I wrote everything down. And at the time, I thought it was the meds or something, but I didn't realize that this pattern of announcing a big event is very common. It's a momentous metaphor, you know, a metaphor of something momentous occurring. And usually people make an announcement that's related to something dear in their life. So for him, it was the art show. My mother was an artist, and for 56 years of their happy marriage, he, quote, schlepped all boxes to her art exhibition. So this thing of announcing, sometimes people might announce the big dance is coming. One woman asked her her son to bring her pearls and a gown for the big dance that was coming. And it was like, Mom, there's no dance. But he brought the things anyway, and then she passed on the next day. But for her, she was a dancer. She loved the big party. So that was the metaphor she announced. And not everyone does this, but it's a pattern that's common enough that sometimes people talk about the big golf game or something very closely associated with who they are and what they care about, the big dinner, the bridge game, I think we had about four cases of this, where someone would announce that there was a threesome of bridge or a threesome of golf, and they needed a fourth, and that they would be announcing that they had to go to be the fourth person in the bridge game. Well, that was something that was some kind of event that was being announced, and perhaps on the other side, or you know, some kind of vision that people were seeing of this event or of this threesome that needed to be completed, and they were the fourth. So those are like the signature metaphors where some kind of momentous event is announced. Now, on the surface, it's sheer nonsense, right? It's nonsense. But when you have the filter, the awareness that people often, before they die, announce some kind of big event, then that helps when we're bedside with people we love to understand that is part of the language of the threshold. And if it's such a common pattern, which it is, are announcing this big event, what is it they're all announcing?
Right.
Like, I mean, is it they're dying, or is it and so?
Or just transitioning.
Or just transitioning. And so there are other indications that there might be something cross-dimensional going on. So that's one very, very common pattern. And oftentimes the metaphors that people use are connected to their lives.
Yeah, you know what? And I want to interject here for a minute, because I find what you're saying so fascinating, and especially with people who are close to death. And this was what was so interesting with my son, Lisa. When he took his life, it was a Monday, and the Thursday before, and what I'm just shocked, all of the kids, all of his friends, the teachers, it's almost as if he reached out to everyone. Mm-hmm. Every single person knew. It's like, hey, we were going to go to lunch. Oh, Nick, I can't believe that I told you I was busy. Nick, you came to my birthday party. It was, and so that to me was amazing, that there is no way that, unless he knew or was preparing, and I know that he was not thinking that I'm going to go, I can't say that because that, obviously means I would know what was in his head. So I don't know that. But at that moment, it did not seem, because I had talked to him just a few hours before on that Thursday. Isn't that interesting that that it's, hey, I'll meet you at the birthday, I'll meet you at lunch, I'll meet you for coffee, and making all these plans. So when he did take his life, it freaked everyone out because they weren't expecting it. He seemed happy.
Wow.
And then Dr. Moody, would you, could you, in a box, would you, could you, with a box, can you share Dr. Seuss? And what, how many books did you say he sold?
600 million, according to the New York Times several years ago. So, as you know, it's nonsense is a big part of kids' lives, too. And it's a lot of kids remember playground rhymes that they enjoyed when they were kids. One very familiar one being, one bright day in the middle of the night, two dead boys got up to fight. Back to back, they faced each other, drew their swords, and shot each other. A deaf policeman heard the noise and came and killed those two dead boys. Or just multitudes of nonsense literature. And although nonsense is very well known in the literary department, it's also a part of music. If you think like Ella Fitzgerald and scat singing, Louis Armstrong scat singing, and doo-wop music of the 1950s, which combined nonsense like sha-na-na-na-na-na with intelligible parts like get a job. And so, but in addition to those recreational aspects and literary aspects, nonsense also has played a big role in the human mind, because nonsense is an expectable response to certain kinds of illnesses like intoxication by mercury, for example, or by ethylene gas, and occurs in schizophrenia. The schizophrenic process makes people make up meaningless, nonsensical words, and or people who are delirious go on and on and on in a certain kind of nonsense. But all of these different kinds of nonsense are determinable structures which have their identifiable patterns. I know it sounds so counterintuitive to say that there's dozens of different types of nonsense, but if you listen to these three sentences, 'twas brillig and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble and the wabe. Well, that's one type, but now listen to this type. Holiness breeds the vestigial lipstick of spontaneity. Obviously, that's yet a different type. Or to listen to this one. That cannibal you men just ate was the last one in this county. those are three different types right there, but they go on and on and on. And
you guys, okay, time out. We're getting ready to head on break, you guys. So hold, would you please, Lisa, I'm coming back to you. Hold that thought, okay?
Thank you.
Can you do it? You guys, thank you for joining us. We'll be back with Lisa Smart and Raymond Moody when we come back. Thanks for listening.
Like the branches of a tree, universal knowledge, insight, and wisdom must be weaved together to bring forward to others. If you live in the Western Washington area, you will want to make the trip to Auburn and visit the new Alchemy of the Goddesses Center. Now open and offering healing sessions, classes, crystals, books, oils, and more. Find out more about the center. Visit alchemyofthegoddesses.com. That's alchemyofthegoddesses.com.
Welcome back, my beautiful listeners. It's hard to believe that this segment is almost over. This hour, I could go on and on. There's so much information and fascinating research that's going into not only near-death experiences, but experiences with others who have lost. And before our last break, Lisa, you had hopped on there. We were discussing about some of the logistical nonsense that is spoken at the threshold. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, I just wanted to illustrate something that Raymond was talking about, is that there are certain types of patterns that emerge through the Final Words Project. And one is called close, and it's a use of repetition that we found in relatively high frequency. So, for example, I'll give you two illustrations. There is so much so in sorrow, right? There was a repetition of the so. Or another one, how much wider does this wider go?
Interesting.
And technically, those are nonsensical. They're nonsensical, and yet there's some kind of meaning conveyed. And that kind of pattern that appears may reveal to us something about how the mind is tracking experience as people approach the threshold. So I just wanted to give that illustration of one of several patterns that appear at end of life.
And so you're saying that, like, when people are close to dying, they'll use words like this that have, like, one word inside, and then they extend them?
Yeah, so there is so much so. So on either side, you've got the repetition, right? There is so much so in sorrow. Or how much wider does this wider go? And then it changes parts of speech.
Right.
Too. So, yes, that kind of pattern occurs. And, I mean, how often in your life do you say, how much
right.
wider does this wider go? I mean, that's a pattern that's not that common in common everyday speech, and yet we saw it emerge in the end of life. So that was intriguing to me, and it's relatively
yeah.
nonsensical because we're not too sure how much wider does this wider go. The person was just said that it sounded like sheer nonsense at the time, but then it's also compelling, right? And with my father, there's so much so in sorrow. To me, that meaning was easily conveyed. For me, it felt like he was saying this is such a sad time. But his language shifted, right? In ordinary daily speech, he would have just said, gosh, I'm really sad right now, right? That's
right.
what he would have said. But instead, it emerged as there is so much so in sorrow. And so we know that different types of language and oftentimes nonsensical language seems to be a flag that we're shifting dimension or something else is going on or there's some kind of altered state. And so for me, seeing those patterns is very compelling and mystifying because what is going on with the mind?
Absolutely.
That kind of shift. In the language.
So do you, now let me ask you on this, do you think maybe they're shifting language because they're nearing going into a different dimension where our 3D words the words just aren't enough to explain?
Well, you know, one thing, yes, I think that might be it. We know that when people have near-death experiences, one of the most common things, if not almost universal things they say, is it was ineffable. There were no words. And one of the things my father said right 3 days before he died, which really caught my interest, was, this is very interesting. I've never done this before. And that's called non-referential language. We don't know exactly what that this is. And I remember hearing that, and I was so curious, like, is he talking about dying? Is that the this, or is there some other this that he's referring to? And so, who knows, right?
Interesting.
It seems like something, and I really wish I had at that time, I wish I knew more, and I would have said, Daddy, what's that this?
this? And Grammarly, I think, what is that called when you say, it gives you a big X, and it'll be like, this doesn't tell you what this, you need to connect it. What is that called? It's like it doesn't,
Yeah, well, it's non-referential. There's no reference. And it's very, that's another very common thing we see at end of life language. You know, it's very beautiful. Or too bad I cannot tell you of all of, too bad I cannot tell you of all of the this. Or it's not what you think.
Those yes.
Words. So what's the it? What's the it? It's not what you think.
Right.
And that it's just such compelling language. And though some of it may at times seem nonsensical, it's worthy of study and it's worthy
yes.
of knowing more. And it's really important, I think, that people just don't disregard it. I mean, it's so scary when someone we love is dying. It's so scary. And yet, to me, the language offers this hope in the sense that there's actually something very sacred going on.
Right. Very good. Thank you for the work that you're doing. I think this is absolutely amazing. And I love that you all have joined teams. You guys, to begin, they just started, you guys, my listeners, the University of Heaven. And I am going to let you all take it away and share with people, what do you want them to know? And you guys can go to, it's theuniversityofheaven.com, and just packed with webinars and with videos and recordings and doctors and, I mean, just very, very, very educated people. So, Raymond, can you share a little bit about why you put this together and what you'd like my listeners to know about it?
Well, I think, as a doctor and a philosopher, that the question of life after death is the most important question of existence. And there is now a lot of really solid information, not made up or hoaxy, but absolutely really solid information about near-death experiences and other aspects indicative of an afterlife. And so what Lisa Smart and I wanted to do through creating theuniversityofheaven.com is our address. And we thought of creating an online educational portal to bring really serious programs on this to people. So we're doing a series of webinars. Our first will be with Dr. Evan Alexander, a former Harvard neurosurgeon who had a profound near-death experience, and his partner, Karen Newell, who has studied the use of tones and healing. And we are soon to have Dr. Anthony Chicoria, a very eminent professor of orthopedic surgeon who had a very profound near-death experience when he was hit in the neck by lightning and had a cardiac arrest, and subsequently became an acclaimed concert pianist because of apparently what he experienced in his experience. And remarkably, a wonderful and talented young graphic artist who was almost killed in a horrific car crash in which his wife was killed and had a profound near-death experience. And to make a long story short, when he revealed his experience to his doctor acknowledged that during his attempt to save the patient's life, which he did, that he knew that the artist wasn't going to die because, as he said, he had a conversation and saw the deceased wife of the patient during the operating room. And other cases like this where the doctors have actually witnessed aspects of the patient's near-death experiences. And we just want a really, really serious study of this. And so please look at, again, the address is www.theuniversityofheaven.com, and all of our webinars are on there. We expect that most people listening to this are hard up for cash like we are, so we are trying to make these programs very inexpensive and yet to bring really serious and solid information about near-death experiences to people. So please look at our website there. And
Lisa, you said you were saying that there was, thank you for that, Dr. Moody. And then you said, Lisa, too, there was a webinar that you all had available, and then you've rescheduled it because there were some technical difficulties. Is that right?
Oh, yes. The joys of being a startup. I'm learning a lot. And it was so funny. We had a webinar, free webinar planned, and somehow between you know, my desk or my husband's desk and the webinar folks, a zero was dropped. We wanted capacity enough for 5,000 people. It was a free webinar. We wanted as many people to join us. And then it landed up, and we had about over 3,000 people, which was such a blessing, who wanted to join. And by mistake, it was registered as only 500 for the
class.
And we felt, I felt so brokenhearted about it. And I sent out an email that said, our goof, your gift, and we're going to do another one.
I saw that, yeah.
And December 8th, and we're going to have capacity for thousands of people.
Excellent.
Because we want to make sure no one is excluded. And that's going to be December 8th. And people can just email me at theuniversityofheaven@gmail.com if they want to sign up right away for that. Or just keep their eyes open, and we'll be announcing it. But they might want to get on the email list so they can find out about that.
Excellent.
So, and then our paid webinars are $15. Where they can get a series of six for $79. So we try to make it affordable. But if people can't afford that, again, the free webinar is going to be December 8th.
Excellent. Thank you for that. And you all, I kind of want to close on this. And it was an interview that you and Dr. Melvin Rose had. And what does this all mean to my listeners? And that is that if we can believe that there is life after life, it is my belief that we learn to live differently. We learn to know things that were important on this earth or in this earth are not as important. And what I loved what Dr. Melvin Rose had said, and is a pediatric and has shared some near-death experiences, but I really liked he goes into cognitive neuroscience, where he says this life is created as an illusion from the brain. When ego disappears, we merge into the universal consciousness that we are all the same being. And what I love, and Dr. Moody, if you can take us out with this, I loved what he said about the mystics, and that we are all drops of water that return to the ocean of consciousness. And collectively, we are all one God conscious. To me, what all this is pointing to is we're all in this together, and we're all just helping each other home.
That's right, and that's what I hear from people all over the world, that during their near-death experiences, they review every single action they've ever done instantly in a holographic panorama. But they say when you re-witness each action of your life, at that moment, you are empathically identified with the person with whom you interacted. So if you see yourself doing something mean, then you feel the sad feelings. Or if you see yourself doing a loving action, you feel the good feelings you bring about in others. So very much so that in these closing moments of life, people, ordinary barriers between people seem to break down.
Yes. You guys, this has been an absolute privilege to have you both on the show. I hope that you'll want to come back with any new information. It just went so fast. And I love the work that you all are doing. You guys, my listeners, I would love it. Go to the University of Heaven. And especially those, I'm loving that you're working too with Ken Ring?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Because anyone who is a skeptic, anyone who is who is like a self-proclaimed atheist, and by atheist, because my husband who had died was a self-proclaimed atheist as well. I do believe you guys that it's not about not believing in a God or something other than what we can see. I believe that his way was, I just don't want the organized religion because I know that there's something more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like to say, I'm from Alabama, so I'm afraid of church. I'm afraid of snakes. I don't go to religion.
You know, one of Jan's, this was my husband, one of his very, very good friends, they called him Quack, and you'll soon see why, but he had said that God is in the question.
Mm-hmm. Oh, what a beautiful thing to say.
I didn't get that 10 years ago, 7-8 years ago, you guys. I didn't get it. God.
That's right.
Yeah.
I love that because it is. That's why, you know, I talk about this, but I'm still in the process of inquiry. I mean, I'm convinced that something exists beyond what I know here, but I also know that I have no idea what it is. And I also know that there's a huge mystery, and the mystery excites me. And I am deeply curious. And that is, to me, God. That really is, because I love to learn and I love to learn more. And I imagine that I will never really know in this body form what it is. It is ineffable. There are no words for it from what we hear from those who have had near-death experiences. Yeah. And I love what your husband said. That is just beautiful.
God is in the question. And I love that. And I think, too, and Dr. Moody, you too. One thing I believe that keeps us healthy, body, mind, spirit, is this curiosity. I've seen so many people with illnesses and people dying because they've closed themselves off to my way is right. It's the only way. We don't know. So I'm kind of like you said, Lisa, just kind of following the breadcrumbs, if you will.
Yeah.
Well, that's how I feel.
I'm convinced after, you know, I just heard so many amazing stories that I don't know what else to say except that there's an afterlife. And, you know, at 74, I always keep a box lunch packed. You know, really. And people my age will understand exactly what I'm saying. The point where it's a natural process of detachment, it is, and it's a wonderful. I'm happy. I feel better in a way than I ever have at age 74, and it's because I'm reconciled. You know, it's really fascinating. To my utter astonishment, there is an afterlife, and your retirement account stops the moment you die.
Yes. Yeah, no money's going with us. I came up with this quote, you guys. It's not who has the most money and the most toys that wins. It's the one that has the most love in his heart who will win.
Angie, I wanted to say one thing because I just love what you said about following the breadcrumbs. And
yeah.
That has very much been my experience with the words at the threshold, because it is like there are these breadcrumbs. And for those who are listening, I would really urge them. It's so hard to lose someone we love, but it's also an incredible honor and opportunity to be with them as they're dying and to imagine that their words, no matter how confusing or perplexing or enigmatic they may seem, to just imagine. Just imagine that they're the breadcrumbs and just follow them, because it really, people may be surprised by what kind of magic emerges and what kind of comfort emerges and insight emerges from those breadcrumbs. I just love the way you phrased that.
Well, thank you. And you guys were at the end. I want to thank you both so, so, so much. And I love you both, the energy that you have and the work that you're doing. You guys, thank you so much for being my guest today.
Oh, Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Beyond Grief Radio with Angie Corbett-Kuiper. Tune in every Wednesday at 12 p.m. Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com as Angie shares through choice, present moment awareness, and keeping an open mind that creating anything is possible, even in death. For more information or to listen to past shows, visit AngieCorbettKuiper.com. That's AngieCorbettKuiper.com. See you next time.